Blog Talk Radio.
Blog Talk Radio.
This is AppSats Radio, help for partners after sexual betrayal. We talk about it here.
Betrayal trauma.
We are AppSats certified clinical partner specialists and coaches who have been trained to help navigate you through this crisis. There is nothing we won't talk about.
Sometimes listeners want to know about triggers.
I'm dealing with the aftermath of my husband's affairs, and he still works the same job that he did when he was acting out. It's a job that allows him to hide his goings-on and one that he stated was the previous trigger for his acting out. The whole 16 and a half years we've been together, he's acted out. In the beginning, what I thought it was just pornography. It ended up being, I found out 2.5 years ago, he had been with multiple prostitutes. I only found out a very small portion of that until about a month ago. How do you cope with all of that when you still have to deal with unavoidable triggers?
Well, of course you would feel traumatized by hearing all that information. And I got to tell you, Stephanie, that's a staggered disclosure. That's finding out little bits and pieces about your husband's behavior throughout a time period, making you feel insecure, unsure, and unsafe. So what we got to do is set up a situation whereby you get with a specialist to do a formal disclosure so you can hear everything at one time in a safe environment.
Yes, it is. And that's why we are here at AppSats.org. We're here to make sure that you're safe. Hi, I'm Carol Jurgensen, Chief, a.k.a. Carol the Coach. And I'm calling all partners. I want you to email me at carol@caroltecoach.com if you want to attend a four-hour workshop on moving through partner betrayal. We're offering it May 1st from 9 a.m. Eastern Standard Time to 1 o'clock, and it's based on the book, Unleashing Your Power. And I am calling all partners because I want this to fill up fast, so I'm hoping that you will email me so I can send you a form, and we can take it from there, because this show is for you. It's for the partner. You know, AppSats was created as a partner-sensitive institute to help you to heal. And we wanted to make sure coaches and clinicians all over the world knew how to do that, knew how to understand trauma, knew what to do with a woman who basically was experiencing the worst thing of her entire life. Now, many times I interview women who have really made it their own to support partners, and I appreciate this field so much because it's filled with professionals that want to help. And so I was talking with a woman and, you know, singing her praises for the work that she's doing, and she said, "Oh, Carol, I got to tell you, you should see what my husband does. I mean, he's really made his mission to help men who have committed betrayal and who struggle with unwanted sexual behavior. He wants to help them with their sexual integrity." And so I said, "Would he be willing to come on the show?" And she said, "Oh, I think so." And so she got us linked together. And he said, "Yes, I'd be happy to talk about what I do to create authentic, healthy living in the lives of men who have been bludgeoned with this addiction." And so he's going to be sharing his focus and how he coaches men to reclaim their integrity. And I just am really excited about this because it's nice when men have recovery and help others and they give it. It's not Sex addiction is nothing to be ashamed of. It is something to learn and to manage. And when you learn how to manage sexual addiction, you're working on your own personal recovery as a sex addict, be it a male or a female. And then, of course, you know, I really believe, as does AFSAT, that it's a relationship issue too. And so it's a relational issue. And so it sounds like Matt does a really good job with helping the betrayer to regulate his emotions, have compassion for his partners, and grow empathetically. And we are all about empathy here, aren't we? So I'm looking forward to figuring out how he does that. I know how I do it. I actually teach the formula. I work on the skills, the relational skills that I know men don't have. And sometimes couples never learned. I mean, the truth of the matter is when I work with couples that have had an experienced partner betrayal, I do know that oftentimes they're dealing with the normal issues that any couple would struggle with. That's the good news. The bad news is it's layered and layered and layered with partner trauma and sometimes sex addiction trauma. You know, I've said this to you before, that I watch a lot of sex addicts get triggered and be very traumatized by watching the trauma they've caused in their lives or their partners. So it's going to be a good show today. I can tell you that right now. I'm speaking to you all the way from Florida, my second home, and my dog's on the couch sleeping. My husband went home yesterday, and I'm here for a couple of weeks. And last time I was here, it was pretty chilly, and it was pretty gloomy. And it was my first extended stay in Florida in my new home. So I am just thrilled that it's a lot nicer here than it was last time. I knew it would be. You got to take the good with the bad, right? And that really is what it's all about. If I could challenge partners to do one thing, no matter how bad their life is, no matter how traumatized they are, and no matter how their spouses have acted out, I would encourage you to at least keep a gratitude journal and identify 1 to 3 things every day. Make it a religious practice to do this every day. I would ask you to ask yourself, what is working? What's working in your life? Because when this kind of thing happens, when partner betrayal is at the forefront of your brain and your brain's gone offline, it is hard. It is so hard to know what is working. And when you get in the habit of figuring that out, I promise you, you'll begin to recalibrate an inch, just 10%, just 20%. But that small percentage grows and grows and grows. So what's working? If I were going to channel my best partner who's had the most trauma, I would say, if I were going to channel her, I was going to be her, I would say, well, you know, one thing that's working is my health. Even though I am very, very anxious and emotionally depressed, I still somehow have good health. I don't have to worry about catching colds or viruses. I don't have any calamity but this. Okay, she'd be thinking, what's working? My health. She would also be a proponent of nature. She loves nature. She loves taking long walks. She is in another country. So she would say, I love my native land. I'm going to go ahead and say it, Poland. And she really, really admires everything that Poland offers in terms of nature. And she invariably is drinking a cup of coffee every time I talk to her. And she loves fine coffees. And I know she would say, I love my coffee. I love a good cup of coffee. It makes me feel happy. So those are the kind of simple things that I want you to focus on. and I want you to be aware of and write them down. Why? Because when you write it down, you make it happen. Don't underestimate the power of the written word. You know, whenever I want something in my life, I write it down and I pray about it. And I do the thing that we've been taught to do, which is to pray for what we want, but leave it up to our higher power to make the decision of whether we get it or not, and to have faith that if we don't, we will get something better. And I don't know, that just in some ways helps you cope with loss and helps you cope with disappointment. And maybe even helps you cope with a little bit of anger. And when you live those principles, there's nothing better. Matter of fact, I have a workbook that is actually called a Carol the Coach workbook. It's 65 creative exercises to help you grow. And it has nothing to do with partner betrayal, but it is about staying positive and working through your life and actualizing your potential. Because ultimately, that's what we're all here to do. No matter how much trauma you've faced, no matter how difficult your life has been, you are 100% responsible for figuring out how you can make some purpose or meaning out of the chaos. Now, that's a pretty tall order, and I don't expect anybody who just had discovery in their own life or just went through a disclosure to be able to flip that switch and look at life that way. Truly, at some point in your life, you'll have the energy back to say, you know, I want some meaning in my life, and I want to know what I can do to make myself feel better. And when you do that, you know, most people on some level, especially as they age a bit, they say to themselves, how can I find purpose and passion in my life? And so our guest today has obviously done that. He's taken a very difficult situation, and he has not only come out of it, but he has figured out how to give back. So, Matthew, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show. I can't wait to hear about you and the work you do, and especially your story. Can you share that with us first?
Yeah, thank you, Carol. It's so wonderful to be here. My story in terms of recovery really got started in 2013, actually August 1st, 2013. My wife had actually started the marriage and family therapy program at Fuller Seminary, where we had just recently graduated, both of us, with Masters of Divinity degrees and plans to be pastors. And she decided to go back and get the MFT degree, and she took a class called Shame and Guilt. And they had a pastor come and give his testimony. It was the first time he'd ever given his testimony publicly, and it was a testimony of really the destruction of sexual addiction on his life and on his marriage, and what it had meant, what it had looked like, and what his process of healing was, where he had gone, all the things he had done. And my wife, as she was hearing this testimony, started to kind of put some pieces together. And while she did not know that that was what I was also struggling with, as this pastor began to tell his story, she began to really kind of make sense of it. And so she came home that day and asked me, after she told me this pastor's story, she said, I want to ask you, is this something that you are struggling with? And up until that point in our marriage and in our dating life, I had always lied. I'd always told her, you know, that, you know, pornography and sexual addiction, that's something I used to struggle with years ago, but I don't anymore, which had been a lie really throughout most of our relationship. August 1st, 2013, hearing that story, I, for some reason, the word yes came out of my mouth when she asked. And that really began our journey of a lot of work. I was pretty sure my marriage was over at that point, and didn't know what was going to be happening. There was a couple weeks of a lot of just kind of chaos and hurt and quiet. And, you know, Joanna came to me and said, if you want to make this right, you've got to get this under wraps. And so we did intensives. We did a lot of counseling. We did a lot of deep therapy work for ourselves and then work as a couple. And I got into a 12-step program and started meeting with guys who identified as addicts and got a sponsor and did everything I could to try to kind of really rid myself of this. Set a lot of boundaries, changed my life kind of upside down. And it was not a smooth process of kind of restoration, though I was really, by the grace of God, have been able to stay sober since that date, August 1st, 2013. But the recovery portion for my wife and I was definitely a lot bumpier. I was not equipped to handle her pain. I wasn't equipped to handle my own pain. That was why I had really turned to addiction to really numb that pain. So to now have to face my own pain for the first time in my life and to face the pain that my wife is going through is a pretty daunting task and not one that I handled very well early on. She really, by the grace of God and just her own love, was incredibly patient with me and gave me some space to figure that out and to get better, of which I've tried to kind of continue to do. And so we did a lot of work to really restore our marriage and to figure out what that looked like. And before long, we began comfortable kind of telling people about our story, and that started putting people into our lives who wanted a lot of what we had been able to accomplish, which was a really restored and reconciled marriage and relationship that we loved. And so we started getting involved in working with other individuals and couples, and it's just been kind of a crazy ride ever since. So.
Well, I can imagine, although when you said we got comfortable telling our story, for so many people, they either don't feel safe telling their story,
yeah.
You know, they don't want to end up spreading information that may be inaccurate or taken out of context, or they want to get to that point, but they're afraid. So can you just share a little bit more about how did you get comfortable telling your story?
Yeah. It definitely took some time. For the first year of recovery, we told three really kind of couples. Early on in recovery, we told her parents, we told my parents, and then we told one couple that we had been extremely close with in grad school. And then we didn't tell another soul outside of our really kind of anonymous recovery groups and therapists for a year. And we did that because we wanted to really focus in on our journey. We wanted to kind of focus in on our healing. After a year came and went, and we had had kind of some sobriety and some safety reestablished, we had done full disclosure. We'd really done some of those big early parts of it. We felt comfortable sharing with our pastor. And so we shared with our pastor of our church, who was really kind in saying, you know, this is a problem in which many folks from our church have come to us. And so you're not alone in this. We want you to know that. And then actually, you know, our counselors really encouraged us to begin to think about who we could tell, you know, what people in our life, you know, Brené Brown says it this way, have earned the right to hear our story, meaning they're not folks who are going to try to fix you. They're not folks who are there to judge you. They're not folks who will spread the information. They're people that you can trust, trustworthy folks. And so that's where we started. You know, we started sharing with folks that we believed to be trustworthy, both individually and as a couple. And that really helped us get comfortable with sharing. And we also talked a lot as a couple about what it looks like to share our story. You know, what we were comfortable sharing, what we weren't. I tried as best I could to honor kind of and really empower Joanna to decide, you know, what are you comfortable with me sharing? What do you want me when I talk about our story, when I talk about my recovery, what makes you comfortable? You know, doing the full disclosure, I think, helped immensely because Joanna knew all along that whatever I shared, it wouldn't be anything she didn't already know. And so I think that was a big, huge component of being comfortable, was that she did have all the information. She's always had, since disclosure, the most of the, you know, the most amount of information. She's always the first person to know any information about me, which is a way in which we kind of maintain safety. So that helped, talking to those safe people. And then we just, like I said, got encouragement from them to share more. And every time we shared our story, someone we knew or someone we talked to would usually call us or email us or text us a few days later and say, I need to let you know I'm struggling with this too. And I'm just so thankful that you shared, because now I have some hope. Now I know I'm not alone. And that encouraged us to kind of get a little more brave, though slowly. And I can remember the first time we shared our story really kind of publicly in front of a crowd, when we were really kind of coming out to say, hey, this is where we've been. And while that did a ton of damage to our marriage, we believe that God is doing a lot to restore it. We shared that story, and our mentor prayed over us that night, and I still remember his prayer. It was, God, may this story not be shared 100 times, but may it be shared thousands of times. And I can kind of remember silently during that prayer thinking, Terry, you've got to shut up. You know, God listens to this kind of thing. I don't know that I want to share that story this many times, but it really has come true. You know, we've just gotten so many opportunities to talk about what God has done in our life individually and kind of in our life as a couple, which has really just been a gift. It's really a blessing.
Well, and I love the fact that you said that you really went to your wife and asked her how comfortable she was with the level of sharing and being open to exposing both of you. I believe that shows our listening audience, Matt, that you are really willing to put her needs even before your own. And that's so important in the beginning of recovery, that she makes sure that she feels safe and stable. You know, that is like the first phase of APSATS, is
right,
like safety and stabilization. So yeah. I love the fact that your mentor endorsed you to the degree of asking that it be heard 1,000 times. It's really encouraged you that you were on the right track, in case you were wondering. I mean, there had to be quite a lot of trepidation about doing this. Can I ask, who
absolutely
did you talk to first as a group? I mean, when you told your story.
Well, you know, a lot of the folks that we had kind of come to know while we were in school. One of the really saddest parts of our journey is that, my wife found out all this information, and our recovery coincided with her 2 years in grad school, becoming a therapist. And I think what's really sad is that, so no one in that program knew going through, and it was so hard. And even I think as I look back, it's become harder to see like how difficult that was for her. And so that telling of our story was to a lot of people who knew us well, knew us from social engagements and knew our marriage to be one that seemed kind of really perfect from the outside. We didn't, a lot of people never assumed we had issues or problems. And so it was really scary in some ways to open up to those people and have them kind of get a different glimpse of us. But it was also people, like I said, we started with people that we knew loved us, we knew cared about us, we knew who wanted our marriage and each of us individually to thrive. And so that made telling the story, I think, that much easier. It really became an opportunity to really thank them for really trusting in us and giving us space to be vulnerable. And in doing that, we really, I think, not right away. I have to be honest. I still get nervous telling my story because it is a vulnerable place. It is a place of vulnerability to share the life that I chose and the actions that I chose and the ways that I was really destructive and the kind of the pain I've caused my wife in that. It's not always an easy story to tell. And yet it is my story, and it is ultimately a story of really redemption and restoration. And so that's what makes it easier to tell. And so, but I think starting with those people who really cared for us and knowing that full well made telling our story that much more accessible.
Well, and like you said, it sounds like you were a model couple from the get-go, from outward perception, and then for you to be so vulnerable and to share, I'm not a model spouse, I have my own issues, mm-hmm. and can you share how you suffered? What sex addiction type did you suffer from?
Yeah. Two phases. I think both really physical interactions with women. I became sexual with female partners early, in life. Started getting physical as soon as fourth or fifth grade. Most of my sexual encounters actually happened around our church youth group or our church youth camps, which is interestingly ironic and in a lot of ways sad. But I really began this pattern early in my life of trying to establish relationships with females and trying to move that relationship on physically as quickly as I could. And that was a way at the time I didn't realize was a way in which I was trying to make up for the deficiencies I saw in myself and in my identity. I wanted to feel better about myself by who I was with and how physical we are. I just saw it as I liked girls, I would say. I liked being with them and having no idea that I was using them really to medicate my own pain. As I got older, and as the internet really became established, that is when that addiction really shifted into pornography for the most part. It still persisted through kind of physical interactions, sexual interactions with females, but mostly what I learned was that the easiest way to hide this kind of drive and this kind of unquenchable thirst was through pornography. I was in a lot of ways a kind of model citizen. I was the saint of my family. I was a straight-A student. I was in leadership at church. I was in ministry by the age of 21. And so there was a certain way I needed to look on the outside. And so I don't know that I can remember a time of kind of having a cognizant choice to say, this has got to really be hidden. But I do remember a couple of times, realizing the way I interacted with women created a reputation for me. And if that reputation really became public, my ministry, my persona, the way people saw me was going to be jeopardized. And so pornography was an easy way in which I was able to put forward this one version of myself and then hide this kind of second version of myself. And that's really what became pervasive for me throughout the rest of my life until meeting Joanna and us starting our relationship. And there were always kind of waxes and wanes of my usage. And of course, I believed the lie that said, oh, I found the right girl and we're going to get married and we're going to be physical together. And that means I won't need this anymore. Really convince myself of that early on in our marriage until I realized that that was not the case. I would go back to self-medicating myself because it's what I've been doing my whole life. And so that's really what I did. Around 6 months into our marriage, I started self-medicating again. I started hiding from her and continued to do that 3 years into our marriage. And I can remember when Joanna started to ask me about why I was pulling away physically from her, avoiding sex because I had either looked at porn that day or recently and had deep shame about it. And I would begin to make excuses and lies, and that kind of continued just to progress on until really the question came on August 1st. And it wasn't the first time I'd been asked. Like I said, she'd asked many times, is this still going on? Is this still happening? But I really believed that if anyone found out about this other life I was leading, they would absolutely reject all of me. They would see me as wholly different and therefore say, you don't belong. You can't be with us anymore.
Yeah, you really took a risk because so oftentimes that can happen within a spiritual environment. And so I'm glad to hear that you were met with understanding and compassion. Now, I got to ask you, obviously, you having that experience set up the framework, if you will, to want to provide that for other men. What modality do you usually utilize in your work with betrayed partners and also, you know, with addicts?
Yeah, Joanne and I both are trained in a therapeutic framework called restoration therapy. It actually is an offshoot of contextual family therapy, and it really is focused around destructive behaviors, specifically in relationships, but really both for individuals and for couples. And it's all about figuring out what those destructive behaviors are that work as those kind of fight or flight mechanisms when we feel emotionally threatened, and then getting to the core emotions that are driving those behaviors. Because what we know is that many of us are good at shifting behaviors when we're either caught or we find out that, you know, people don't like it when I get angry, or they don't like it when I withdraw. So folks are really good, and I think we see this in addiction circles quite often. People just bounce from addiction to addiction, substance to substance, but they never actually get to the root. And so restoration therapy is about getting to the root in all of our destructive behaviors so that I can really begin to move away from them. And we had actually discovered this modality before our recovery and had done some fairly significant work in our own relationship in terms of conflict resolution and communication and kind of how we worked as a team. What we didn't know was that when we went through recovery, it would be the absolute key to my sobriety and I think our restoration, because it gave us the framework to be able to show up for each other in really difficult moments. It gave me the framework eventually, and I don't want to pretend as if day one I was there, but eventually to really be present for Joanna as she would share her pain, as she would open up about the impact of what I had done. And it really gave me ultimately the framework to see my process of addiction and how, you know, pornography and masturbation and these behaviors were really these 9th, 10th, and 11th steps of this cycle of pain and destructive behavior that would lead up to this acting out. And so that's what we still use. And we use it because it worked with us, and we use it because it works with the folks that we work with. And I think what we love about it the most is it's really designed to be used by the client. You know, as a coach, I do psychoeducation with a lot of my clients. I help them to discover their core emotions, to discover their destructive behaviors, but also to name and discover the truth about who they really are and what they get to do out of that truth instead of those kind of destructive reactions. So that's the framework that we still use as kind of a core component of how we, you know, help people deal with really the destruction of betrayal. And all we've done kind of as a couple is to take that process and to really kind of lay out a journey for couples of restoration that, you know, what are the components and pieces that it looks like as we move forward.
Well, and so what do you see as the greatest struggle, you know, for betrayers in this process?
I mean, I think the obvious one off the get-go is folks who have turned to, you know, pornography, who have turned to affairs, sexual acting out behaviors, have done so because of their inability to handle their emotional pain and experiences in childhood. And so, you know, the biggest struggle, you know, with the guys that I work with, the betrayers that I work with, is their life avoiding hard emotions. They have spent their life numbing difficult experiences. And so, you know, in a lot of ways, they are thrown into the lion's den because they are facing the things that they have done the least to train for, you know. And so I'm really honest with the guys I work with and say, you know, we live in San Diego, and I said, you know, a little bit of what we're going to be doing is like sending you out into the Pacific on a stormy day, and you've never swam before, because you're not equipped to do the work right away of being present for your spouse, but you're going to have to learn how to do that in a really efficient and timely manner, because putting her on hold while you get yourself together is just another layer of the destruction that you've caused. And I think that's probably the hardest part. I've really come to this realization in the last couple of years that Joanna not only experienced the pain of my betrayal, but also the pain of the time it took me to become capable to really hear her story, to be able to be present in her pain in a way that wasn't re-triggering for her. I didn't do that right away. There were many conversations that ended with me angry or me in shame or me withdrawing, and that wasn't fair for her. In some ways, that really was a double betrayal. It was a continued kind of betrayal of what I had promised her on our wedding day, which was to be there in sickness and in health, in good times and bad. And so not only had I left the relationship in terms of infidelity and betrayal behaviors, but I had left the kind of rebuilding process early out of an inability to handle my own emotions. And so, and I think that is a reality that, like I said, most betrayers, you know, are going to have to face, because, you know, I tell the guys, if we were good at handling our pain, we probably wouldn't be as addicted to the substances we are. And so it's a very, very steep learning curve. And it's also one that can happen. I've seen countless guys do it. I've done it in my own life. It's not impossible, but we would be lying if we said it'd be automatic.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I know you talk to the men a lot about empathy, and you know that's one of my favorite subjects. So tell our listening audience what you see empathy as, and how do you help the guys to learn it?
Yeah. So a couple of ways. I mean, for me, empathy, the way I describe empathy is connecting experiences to pain. And so a lot of what I see empathy is being able to see someone's experience and to hear their experience and to make sense then of their pain through that experience. And so, you know, when a wife discovers that her husband has been looking at pornography and viewing pornography after she goes to bed every night for 10 years in their marriage, it makes absolute sense for her to question her body, her attractiveness, her worthiness, but also to question her safety, you know? And so empathy is about seeing the connection of those two things and realizing, you know, that it makes perfect sense that you would feel that way, because I can see this experience and how it would absolutely communicate this about you or about your relationships. I think that's really the heart of empathy, is the ability to see that story and that narrative unfolding, even if it's not one that I've had specifically myself. You know, we really usually coach our betrayers not to use that word, "I understand." Because we try to be very frank with them. Like, unless you have been betrayed by your partner, you don't understand. You can get it. You can make sense of it. You can see it. You can hear it. you can even connect with it out of maybe your own experience of pain, but the understanding isn't fully there, and that's okay. So empathy is really important in terms of being able to see those things. In terms of helping with guys to do that, one, we try to get great resources. I'm gonna tell you, I love your workbook. I have a group of guys that we use it regularly. We go in and we love exercises, because I think one of the things that I've seen that helps guys is to have material that they can kind of lean into in a safe space, so that they can then go into trickier spaces, more vulnerable spaces with their spouses, and practice the things that they've been learning. So we have a group that is a restoration group that I lead, and it's all about men who want to really restore love and trustworthiness back in their relationships, and want to specifically do that in through their ability to grow as kind of empathetic human beings. Because what we know is when I'm really betraying my intimate partner, it is partly because I do not have the practice of empathy. Because if I did, I would think very differently about the nature of my behaviors and betrayal. And so having those practices is really key. One of the things I've learned just in this process of working with men is that it's usually helpful for them to begin practicing empathy on folks who they have not injured first, because there is less at risk for them emotionally to do so. They find it's a little easier for them to practice empathy when they're not the victimizer. And so one of the things we do in the group is I encourage the guys, when someone shares of their pain or struggles, to practice empathy with each other first, as a way of kind of a safe way of doing that and practicing and kind of getting used to that framework. And then the other key component we found is that I have the guys practice empathy on themselves.
Okay,
many,
tell me.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
So what that looks like is we've taken wonderful exercises like we find in your workbook, and we say, okay, the core of this is about understanding your wife's experience and the pain that she's in. Can you do the same for yourself? Can you understand your own core experiences and the pain that they caused you? How were you victimized? What pain did that cause? And how can you show up in a way for yourself that says, you know what? I get it. I get why you feel so defective. I get why you feel like you don't matter. I get why you feel so out of control, so trapped, so unsafe. Now, we're really big about none of that makes the behavior okay. You know, none of that is about saying it's fine what I did. In fact, it's about saying, hey, the behavior that came out of that pain just caused you and the people you care about more pain. Acknowledge the deepness of your pain and the difficulty of it. And let's be compassionate towards that person as we still hold them accountable. And that's really been a key in really helping the guys that I work with, I think, see the depth of their wives' pain. You know, so many of us are wanting someone to do the work for us rather than kind of doing the work for ourselves. We want, you know, so many of the guys I work with want their wives to make them feel like they're enough. You know, they want their wives to make them feel like they're a good man. And a lot of the work I do is in coaching them and saying, that's your responsibility. It's your responsibility to treat yourself like you're enough, like you're a good man. Because that's what's going to allow you to show up in that way for her when she is dealing with just the deep, deep destruction of your behavior. And so it's been really helpful, and it's really helped them to enter into that kind of space and practice of empathy with their partners, because they've got the tools, they've got the practices, they've seen the framework at work, even in their own life, which has really helped them show up in a really cool way.
Yeah, that makes total sense. And I love that you're teaching these guys empathy and you're letting them use it on themselves. And I know very clearly in group settings that men are better at watching empathy, learning from empathy, and demonstrating empathy if they know it's going to be safe. And let's face it, oftentimes in a couple, especially one ravaged with partnered betrayal, everybody's defenses are up and it's not always going to be received in the way that it needs to. And this is no bad-mouthing partners, but they don't trust it. They don't believe it. They want to see somebody do it over and over and over again, regardless of their reaction. Yeah. So, you know, I'm going to ask you, Matt, because we're kind of wrapping up here. I want to know what's something you would like partners to know? If you were just going to throw something out there.
Yeah, I think two things is that I think partners have a absolute reason to be deeply frustrated with the process of recovery. I think that early designs of recovery weren't designed to care for the absolute damage and destruction done for the partner. And we're still seeing a lot of the last remnants of that. You know, I can remember in recovery groups, you know, where people were saying things like, now don't tell your wife that, and only tell her this, and make sure you don't, you know, and very kind of addict centric in terms of you just need to be okay. You can worry about your wife or your marriage later. And I think that was just done at such a disservice. And I know even to this day that even though there's been tons of work, and I'm so thankful for organizations like ABSAT to have come along and really shown us what we've needed to see, I'm in the recovery community enough to know that those perspectives, those partner perspectives, have not yet gotten that full adoption and I think that full recognition. And I still, to this day, meet with couples who have had really awful experiences, either from friends who have communicated certain things to partners, like, this is your fault, this was your doing, to, you know, experiences with pastors who said things like, you know, well, if you gave him more sex, or I don't, you know, your body's not your own. I mean, just really, really damaging experiences. And I think the Trayer community specifically needs to be a community that is a loud voice that says this wasn't right for the people who were damaged by our behavior. And we need to make it right in how we move forward and how we address recovery for couples, for individuals, but most specifically for partners. One of our a program we're really excited about, there's a online small group support group, and one of the things they do is all of their partner groups are free, and they're paid for through the funding of the men and their small groups, and we love that. We love that partners are able to get a free resource to get support and people who know their story, because betrayers are willing to say, hey, we need to pay our debt back. And we're partly going to pay it by making sure that the people we've hurt have access to good resources. So I think just acknowledging that, I think that has to continue to be said, and to not be lost in stories of redemption and restoration. You know, my wife and I have an incredible story of restoration, and she still had to start her own support group. She went to a therapist that told her that, you know, you're codependent and you're probably a reason this has all been going on, even though she had no idea. And so even in our story of healing, there is still story of damage and pain, not just done by me, but in our recovery process. The other side, though, I think I want partners to know is that there is incredible healing when you are able to safely take the risk to allow someone to restore. What we know is that healing comes most often from the people who do the damage to us. So we get that fullest healing when the people who have hurt us are the people who get to restore. And I just hope that more and more partners have the chance to receive healing and receive care from the people who have hurt them. it won't happen all the time, and that's the sadness of this. But when it does, it is such a gift to be able to give to people who didn't deserve to be hurt in the first place. And so I work with a lot of partners early on in the process, and I say, there's no reason to trust this man. There's not. And that's not what we want to ask you to do. But if you can be open to the process for yourself, you may find out that he shows up and puts back in many ways what he took. And that is what you deserve. You deserve someone in your life who will put back what they took from you and from your relationship.
Well, that's a good point. And, I want to ask, how can people get a hold of you if they want to work with you, if they want to work with you and Joanne, or if they want to participate in some of your programming?
Yeah, the easiest way is through our website. It's www.renovatelove.com. And, we work with folks locally. We work with folks across the country. We do a lot of coaching couples and individuals. We've just started launching groups, and so I'm excited to get started with a couple of more restoration groups for men who really want to go through that process of restoration and empathy and don't want to do it alone, And so that's probably the best way for folks to find us. There's a form they can fill out, and it will get us in touch, and we usually get to have a good conversation with them about all the different ways we might support them.
Well, Matt, thank you so much for the work you're doing. And, I'm such a proponent of couples work. I'm so glad the two of you are working together. I'm glad you were vulnerable, brave, and courageous to be authentic and transparent. And I just want to keep hearing what you and Joanne are doing so that we can spread the word. We need this out there. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Carol. Such a pleasure to be with you. I appreciate it.
All right. Have a great week. So that obviously is a man who understands. He's been through it himself. He watched his wife's trauma, and he knows that he has to be able to give back to basically make a difference in the world. And I don't want to say redeem himself. It was kind of the same thing he said when there's no way that you can right the wrongs of something like this with your wife, or your husband, whoever the offender and the offended happens to be. But truly, if you can take the kind of suffering and create great transformation and use it to give back, you have really made a difference in this world. So be thinking about what you can do, whether it's being a Sunday school teacher for your own grandchildren or volunteering at a humane society, or getting into the APSAT's coaching and clinician program. We'd love to have you. You can go to APSAT.org for more information. And I just want to say, as I always do, there'll only be one of you at all times, so fearlessly have the courage to be yourself. Make it a great one.
For more information, go to APSATS.org, the Association of Partners of Sex Addicts Trauma Specialists, to find a professional in your area who is trained to help you after sexual betrayal.